From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean, with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. All right, so the game continues in Honduras. So it's now it's 2 weeks, 3 weeks since the election, a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And this is typical in Honduras, Don. Do you remember in our last conversation I said to you that it's very unlikely that the will of the Honduran people will be respected, certainly by the local oligarchy, and in particular probably by their U.S. masters in the State Department in Washington?
Right. When the U.S.-backed candidate, you know, when the oligarch's candidate wins, the vote count happens pretty quick. They certify him, and they're in the presidential palace eating a celebratory dinner inside of 2 minutes. When it looks like they're losing, suddenly it takes 100 years to count the votes in. Guess what? He won anyway.
Yeah. So then what are we looking at? And you and I just looked up the OAS, the Organization of American States website, and it looks as though even the Organization of American States electoral observers are proposing that there be new elections because the recent elections were so vitiated by fraud. Not on the day of the actual day of the elections was a model day. But Salvador Nasralla lost the count when the Honduran Electoral Authority, the electoral tribunal there in Honduras, stopped the count, alleging technical problems. There was my information is that there was a 4-hour period in which they switched hard drives across the system, and then they started producing results again maybe two days later.
Right. This is what the OAS said. They say deliberate human intrusions in the computer system, intentional elimination of digital traces, the impossibility of knowing the number of opportunities in which the system was violated. In other words, they wiped out those records, the transaction records. Pouches of votes open or lacking votes. The extreme statistical improbability with respect to participation levels within the same department. In other words, as against the exit polls and who showed up and who didn't. Recently printed ballots and additional irregularities added to the narrow difference of votes between the two most voted candidates and made it impossible to determine with certainty the winner.
Well, and that's that they know very well who won the election. Right. It was Salvador Nasralla, the progressive candidate that won it. And they're just covering their backs.
Right.
And they don't want their right wing patrons to be cross with them, you know. And so, right. But I think the key factor there was, and I'm actually quite surprised by this, was the fact that it seems that the European Union observer, which is led by I think it's a woman from Italy, just refused to sign off on stuff, and if the European Union said, oh, well, nothing to see here, everybody move along, then the Organization of American States would have gladly done the same. But because the European Union delegation just couldn't stomach the level of corruption and fraud that was involved, and the OAS was put on the spot.
Right.
So, you know.
Hey, you know, something else. What's his name? Almagro. Says that what he wants, his remedy, he's picking, I have decided to designate as special representatives former presidents Jorge Quiroga and Alvaro Colom. Notice who's missing from that.
Alvaro Colom's okay. And he's very much, he would be very much in sympathy with Salvador Nasralla. And of course, Quiroga is a right wing. You know, I'd call him a fascist.
But who's missing? Who's missing from that? What about that guy that was elected president that was removed in a coup d'etat?
Oh, right.
He's still floating around. Mel Zelaya.
Yeah, but and of course they have to kind of dress it up in independence and impartiality, right?
Right.
So anyway, and that Let's see what happens. And as we said last week, this is just going to drag on and on. The right wing oligarchy and the U.S. government backers are going to do everything they can to make sure that their boy wins. And we'll just have to see what happens. And in technical terms, in kind of administrative, strictly administrative legal terms, never mind the fraud. And the Honduran Electoral Tribunal has nominated Hernandez as president. So, and that's like, there's huge inertia involved in that.
Right.
How is that going to be turned around? There have to be new elections. But you and I said this last week, and there should have the delegation's concern should have said, look, this election was completely corrupt. The count was completely corrupt. There have to be new elections. They should have said that kind of 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And now they're finally saying it.
Yeah. Well, when they say, in essence, they're admitting that the records of the election were tampered with and essentially destroyed. So right. that means you have to do it again. There's no other way. You can't reconstruct it. The OAS even says essentially what actually happened has been tampered with and it can't be reconstructed. So there's no way to do it without a new vote.
Right. So looking at the broader regional context, what that means from the point of view of Luis Almagro, who's a kind of this odious clown running the Organization of American States,
right,
on behalf of his U.S. State Department,
yeah,
owners. And he's essentially saving the credibility of the Organization of American States.
Such as it is.
Because if they hadn't come up with something along the lines of what they've said now,
right,
very late in the day, the OAS would have lost all credibility, and they
need it.
That's particularly important because they can't target Venezuela and give a gangster like Juan Orlando Hernandez a free pass. Even from a right wing point of view, they can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, they're not the only game in town anymore. That's the thing that's sort of betrayed by the role that they're forced to play now. You know, for many years, since the creation of the OAS, that was the primary multilateral organization in the hemisphere. And particularly with the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 and the rise of the multilateral project that was developed with Venezuela and the ALBA countries at the center of it in a lot of ways, you had CELAC and all these different places, finally UNASUR, where everybody except the U.S. and Canada participate more or less, where people can take their grievances to the whole, the whole region, to the governments of the whole region, without the U.S. mediating it. And the people of those countries got used to that also. You know, once that happened, there's a whole different narrative that goes with it. And so when they have to go back to their own people, whether it's a right-wing government and even a right-wing electorate or not, they can't just go in on a fantasy that everyone knows is fake, because at UNASUR, at whatever other multilateral group the country participates in, the people there will be talking about this joke at the OAS.
Right. Yeah, and essentially, Luis Almagro is struggling to save the OAS credibility.
Right.
And I think it's worth pointing out, and this is something I feel strongly about, the role of CARICOM, the Caribbean nations, within the Organization of American States. If you look at that, if you analyze that over the last 2, 3, 4 years, and it's been very interesting the way that even kind of center-right CARICOM countries work together with the other Caribbean island nation governments. They've supported Cuba resolutely. And I think largely as a result of Venezuela's influence in the Caribbean, because it's easy to forget that Venezuela, right, in many ways, is a Caribbean country,
right?
Because of its geography.
Right.
It's at least as much a Caribbean country as Trinidad and Tobago or Guyana, right?
That's right.
So CARICOM has defended Venezuela, and it's the CARICOM countries that prevented Luis Almagro getting the technical majority that he needed in the Organization of American States, some political council, for initiating much more severe sanctions from the Latin American Caribbean region against Venezuela. It was CARICOM that prevented that. And that's
right.
And they've also, as I said, been extremely resolute defending Cuba. And they recently had a conference with Cuba. What was it? Two or three months ago, CARICOM and Cuba had their conference.
Yep, that's right.
In which they agreed to maintain a common position on a series of issues and agreed to disagree on other issues. But I mean, that's so important in terms of presenting a common front against the imperialist designs of the United States government and its allies in the regional oligarchy. And something interesting that I, just a footnote really to what we've been talking about with regard to Honduras. And today or tomorrow, I think it is, in Cuba, the municipal councils of people's power start operating. And this is you know, a tremendous example of the grassroots democracy that Cuba embodies. Because what you're going to have is ordinary people across the country actively participating in real decision making about what happens in their communities. You know, imagine that in Honduras in the current context. I mean, forget it. And so people need to be very aware. I'm sure most of our listeners probably are already very aware. But that's just another example of the way that genuine grassroots democracy goes, set up in a revolutionary system, can just completely contradict the anti-democratic, anti-humanitarian, essentially politically repressive logic of the electoral democracies of North America and Western Europe.
So then the
other big event over the weekend was the election result in the presidential runoff in Chile,
right,
which was between, as our listeners probably already know, Alejandro Guillier, the kind of the centrist candidate, can hardly call him a progressive candidate given many of his policies, and the right-wing candidate Sebastián Piñera, who's had already had one term as president prior to the current term of President Michel Bachelet. Sebastián Piñera had a good win on a low turnout. Turnout was something like 48-49%.
Yeah.
51-52% abstention.
Right.
And as we said, you and I said last week, that and if there was a low turnout, that would favor Piñera. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And he got out of the turnout, he got about 54.58% of the vote as opposed to 45.42% apparently.
Right. So, and that's a very disappointing result from the point of view of progressive forces in Chile. But one has to remember that there's been a huge change in the legislative makeup of the Chilean Congress because Beatriz Sánchez's Frente Amplio won a very large number of deputies compared to kind of all virtually zero representation in previous Chilean legislatures. As a result of the recent legislative elections, the Frente Amplio, which is the kind of alliance of the most progressive and radical parties in Chile, they finally got their act together after many years of disarray. And they did very well. They've been very successful in getting, and I can't remember the exact number of seats, I think it's over 20 in the Chilean legislature. And that's going to make life much more difficult in terms of perhaps not in terms of Piñera getting his legislative agenda through Congress, although it remains to be seen what the Guiar Alliance legislators, what is going to be their attitude to the measures that Sebastián Piñera is likely to propose. And one of the reasons that Piñera did so well is that he appeared to make concessions in terms of making state education more accessible to ordinary people. But in terms of the other big, there are various major issues in Chile. One is abortion, and another is the pension fund administration system, which is hopelessly biased against the interests of the majority of people in Chile. And it's not clear to me what's likely to result in terms, because Guiar was very resistant to change, whereas the Frente Amplio were pressing him to make a radical decision in as regards the administration of pensions in Chile. He refused to do that, and so it's likely that Piñera will be able to cobble together some kind of arrangement that maintains the current extremely unjust pension arrangements in Chile in support of the profits of his corporate supporters. So that pension issue, that whole pension issue is very important in the region. If you look at what's happening in Brazil, for the first time in many months, the administration of, is it Michel Temer or Julius Temer? I feel like I always Michel Temer. He suffered a major defeat in the Brazilian Congress over his proposed pension reforms, and that I was reading an article about that last night. And it looks as though, and this commentator, who's a kind of center-left commentator, was saying it would be easier to find a refrigerator at the North Pole than a political analyst that gives a snowball's hell in chance in hell of Temer passing his pension legislation, right, which Temer said. We're going to hang on to this, and we'll try and vote on it in February next year.
Yeah, apparently he says that he's 2 or 3 dozen votes short of being able to push through his proposal. And I guess he had some kind of urinary tract surgery last week also, so he used that. I'm in the hospital. We'll have to postpone the vote.
Right, yeah. If you put that in the broader context in Brazil and in the regional context. And in Brazil, the specific context is that Lula Ignacio da Silva is streets ahead of anybody else in terms of electoral popularity and Brazil goes to elections in July next year. So something like 6 months away from the elections, Ignacio Lula da Silva is the overwhelming favorite to win those elections. But he still faces an important legal hurdle, and it remains to be seen what will happen with regard to that. Because, and across the region, as you and I have mentioned on various occasions over the last year and a half, 2 years, and there's been this judicialization of politics. Or maybe it's the politicization of judicial systems. It doesn't matter how you kind of describe the mechanism, but essentially the legal systems throughout the region have been exploited and manipulated by right-wing governments to attack left-wing political opponents with specific electoral objectives. The attack against Cristina Kirchner currently going on in Argentina is a response to the fact that she got elected to the Senate in the recent legislative elections. And the right, Macri's right-wing government, which has become more and more repressive, as you and I said it would,
oh, yeah,
And years ago, I mean, immediately after that win, it was just right. So obvious.
Right away. They started right away. They started in on it. Yeah.
So then, the judicial system in Argentina is being manipulated, despite, forget about evidence. These processes in Latin America and probably anywhere else don't need evidence. It's enough for the process to be set in motion.
Right. Same here in the U.S., by the way. That's what they're doing in the U.S. at this point also.
Right. So they set up this judicial administrative statutory dynamic, which is specifically designed to either cripple the electoral possibilities of the target person. In the Argentina's case, it's Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. In Brazil, it's Lula Matheus da Silva. In Ecuador, it's the possibilities of the team of former President Rafael Correa with the legal, the imprisonment, in fact, and the sentencing on spurious corruption charges of Rafael Correa's colleague Jorge Glass, who was the vice presidential candidate in recent elections. But Ecuador's another story. We need to talk about that separately. But the pattern is absolutely clear. And so if they can't make it impossible for these candidates, left-wing candidates, progressive candidates, to stand in elections, what they try and do is smear them in such a way that they'll lose electoral support. And that's what all these judicial processes are about.
Yeah, it's not just left-wing either, by the way. You know, the U.S. has been doing this kind of game in Latin America, certainly its backyard, since, Monroe. But, they've been doing this around the world in post-war Italy and, across Europe, really, and throughout Africa and Asia. And they've imported it back to the United States now. And they'll attack even the right-wing extremists using the same methodology if it's not someone that's on the team. That's what we just saw with this guy Moore. I don't know whether he actually did any of the things that he was accused of, but I do know there hasn't been a bit of evidence presented, and it's widely accepted that he did these things without that evidence. And it's, that's not a condition that should prevail in a society that's supposed to make major decisions based on facts and information.
Right, and returning to Latin America, you can see that happening with the President Kuczynski in Peru.
Yeah,
he's now caught up in the Odebrecht scandal. I've been trying to puzzle that out. Why would anybody go after Kuczynski? Why would the right wing, and he's very right wing candidate. He's a business sector candidate.
Yep.
He's somebody that supports all the major U.S.-sponsored free trade initiatives, neoliberal economic policies. He's all up for that.
I mean, they're going after him hard. They've submitted an impeachment motion against him in Congress.
Yeah. Now, if you look, why is that happening? And the only rational answer I can come up with that is because the local Peruvian oligarchy and its homologues across the region don't want to see Bolivia progressing. They want to keep, and because in Bolivia, Evo Morales has recently established his right to stand for re-election in the next presidential elections in Bolivia.
Right, so they're going to continue. that whole process that's been going on in Bolivia is going to continue.
Yeah, so, but who has thrown a lifeline to Bolivia in its fight to get access to the sea?
Right.
It's precisely Kuczynski.
Right.
Kuczynski has offered Bolivia a complete package of access to the sea via a port called Ilo in the south of Peru. and that is part of the Chinese, the Latin American extension of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, because ELO would be the start, the departure point for maritime shipping arriving on Peru's Pacific coast, and heading down to a port on the southern Atlantic coast of Brazil.
Yeah, this is really some interesting stuff here. I mean, you're talking right now. Bolivia has to use the northern Chilean ports for commerce, and instead we're looking at a 99-year lease under Bolivia's control for a port that's with an international highway to it. So they've got direct contact to the, you know, Silk Road, Belt, and whatever project they call it when it comes this way.
Yeah, and so from Bolivia's point of view, that's and because it still essentially depends on its exports of gas and minerals. Having unfettered access to that port at ELO in Peru,
right,
means that it can freely export its produce and materials, not just to China but also to India,
right,
because India's got huge investments in Bolivia. So, and as you say, it opens up a whole other perspective on what's going on in Latin America, what's going on in Asia, what's going on in terms of the United States government's ability and the U.S. corporate elite's ability to stem their inevitable decline vis-a-vis the incredibly powerful forces, the urban economic forces that are being unleashed by China, by the Russian Federation,
India,
and by those countries' allies across over there in Asia. And so, and this brings us back to another point that you and I have touched on at different times over the last couple of years, and that is, and what is going, who, how is the argument going to pan out between within the right-wing oligarchies in Latin America? Because what you have is, you have these factions that are very well aware that the United States economy and the United States corporate elites are essentially a global power in decline. So what is going to be their response to that? And there are fierce arguments about how to manage that.
You know, you have that. That's like the macro picture. And then you have like the more immediate, like transactional aspects also, which is something we've discussed. Like, you know, the sheer force of economic activity that the project that was set in motion by Chavez and others, drew so much, you know, gravity, basically, that even right-wing governments that were politically, inconsistent or contradictory to, say, the Venezuelan government, the Nicaraguan government, whatever, were compelled and, you know, positively incentivized to do business with them because they made money doing it. Here, right, what if you can open up the interior of South America to China, you know, to the commerce with China, India, and the rest of the world without having to pay the United States or corporations benefiting from the United States, whatever. In other words, remove the American monopoly and let businesses in Brazil and Peru and these other places do business with whomever they want. They like that. They make money doing that. And that is an incentive for them to say, you know what, okay, well, we have, you know, the global picture is changing, so here's our political cover for this, but hell, I'm going to make some more money doing this deal, let's do it. And I think that drives a lot of it, too.
Yeah, and I think that there's some element of that is going on, for example, in what's happening in Venezuela.
Yep.
And the right-wing business community there look at what's going on in their own country, and they see that they're up against what is essentially an immovable force.
That's right.
Which is Chavismo in Venezuela.
Right. The people.
And they've been unable to defeat Chavismo despite everything that they've tried. So what are they going to do?
Right.
Are they going to destroy their country in a civil war, or are they, as you just said, going to start making some money with China and Russia and the other Asian economy?
And Nicaragua is a perfect example of how the local business class can do well, and we'll pick it up there next week, Tony, because we're out of time.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.